WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, WXXC Truxton.
So basically what they're doing there is taking credit for six of the dead Panthers that are not attributable to police causes at the time. A body count, and that's the indicator of a successful operation. So pseudo gangs and the exacerbation of intergroup tensions, and there's a number of other examples of a similar sort that I could run down. That's the next level. Beyond that, you involve the friendly local police departments for pretext arrest. Philadelphia, 1967, you got a very long report after a summer's repression of the Revolutionary Action Movement that said basically we've had the local police work in cooperation with the local police to have them arrest these guys time after time after time on any pretext. We're not looking for convictions. We're looking for arrests. If we can force them into an arrest situation, then we're tying them up in jail until they can make bail. When they make bail, they're having to expend resources they would use for other activities and put themselves back in the street. And guess what? When they walk out the front door of the police station, we arrest them again for spitting on the sidewalk and put them right back in the cell. We've had situations where after about six or seven rounds of this, we've got veteran organizers who are laying on the floor in their living rooms and they're being arrested for the ninth time, crying and kicking the floor. They're so frustrated as they're being hauled away again. We got a guy who got, we got his parole revoked for possession of a deadly weapon. Turns out to be a 3/4-inch blade penknife. This is pretext stuff. It has nothing to do with law enforcement. It has everything to do with neutralizing people they've identified as being, quote, key activists. If that's not sufficient, if you got good legal counsel, if you can mount the bail, if your organization is functioning properly, they go into things that are more extravagant, which is bringing about essentially false imprisonments, which is fabrication of evidence and so forth in order to obtain the conviction and sentencing of targeted activists. Geronimo Pratt is a key case of that. Druba Bin Wahad is a key case of that. Rice and Poindexter, key cases of that. Leonard Peltier is a key case of that. You can keep on running them down. And interestingly enough, the more obviously innocent you are, the better they like it. So you keep trying to prove that, say, Leonard Peltier is innocent. Demonstrate that to people. They want that demonstrated, because it demonstrates the arbitrariness of their ability to visit consequences upon you of an unacceptable fashion, something you will not to incur, want to incur as a consequence to yourself. But they can do it despite the fact that you're glaringly innocent. They can put you in prison for the rest of your life. That sends the requisite message. I guess the concomitant of that is the extent to which we could get people like Peltier out, Mumia off death row, and so forth. Sends a reverse message back to them. But the horsepower to get that done hasn't really been forthcoming, by and large. Finally, when all else fails, as it did with Fred Hampton, they kill you. They usually use surrogates to do it. They usually use surrogates to do it, but probably not always. Hampton's the classic case. I've already talked about Hampton. There was Mark Clark, who was also killed in the apartment with him. We should talk about that. But beyond that, you got something into, we'll bring it up to 1990. The guy who ran the cartoon campaign, United Slaves Black Panther Party, was a junior agent by the name of Richard Wallace Held. Richard Wallace Held is the son of Richard G. Held. Richard G. Held is the architect of COINTELPRO I quoted with regard to neutralization a while ago. This is a family business. Father taught the son excelled from day he hit the ground with the FBI. He was running the counterintelligence section, the Black Panther desk in Los Angeles, almost from the moment he got a field assignment with the FBI. Richard Wallace Held is the guy who put out the phony information on Jean Seberg that led to her miscarriage and ultimate suicide to neutralize Friends of the Panthers. Richard Held is the guy who fabricated the evidence to put Geronimo Pratt in prison for 27 years. Richard Held is the guy they brought in as a specialist on the Resmers investigation to bring about the false conviction of Leonard Peltier. Richard G. Hale was ultimately rewarded at a very young age for an FBI agent with being named the special agent in charge of the San Francisco office of the FBI, in which capacity he presided over the car bombing of Daryl Cherney and Judy Berry. This is a professional occupation, a neutralizing political activist. Now, it finally started to come out a bit on the Berry Cheney end of things, at which point he took an early retirement. Anybody out there got a Visa card? Come on, fess up. I know you're anarchist, but somebody out there has a Visa card. Yeah. Okay, you should feel very comforted because Dick Hale took an early retirement as a SAC San Francisco. He was being groomed to be an associate director of the FBI by the time he was 55 years of age, which is astronomically young. That's successful. Okay, he's very much rewarded for the sorts of stuff I'm talking about. But since it started to come out and that would look bad for the Bureau, we put him on early retirement. He now ensures the fact that you can use your Visa card, okay, free from worry that frauds will take your number, okay, and use it for purposes of their own. He's head of security for the Visa Corporation these days. And that's one final thing I want to say in terms of technique before I tie this up, an overlong talk it was at that, and get into some filling of the holes, is that you can't just look to the roster of agent personnel. Dick Held has access to all the information on how you spend your money if you travel on Visa. And that includes your whereabouts, your locations, how you travel, when you travel, probably why you travel, your spending patterns. That's critical information, intelligence sense, and it's handed over directly to the FBI. It's fed right in a list of target activists. And Hoover worked this out years and years and years ago. In 1924, when the Congress of the United States exercised its authority because the FBI had been aimed at them as it was during the Watergate era, okay, it was doing things to the good senators and representatives over there, and so they put a clamp out, said you can't engage in political investigative activity anymore, and he said, yeah, I agree, that's fine. I want to be out of the political repression business once and for all. You make me director, I will keep it that way. And then he began to take his top aides and assign them, basically set them up for jobs running industrial security operations for major manufacturing concerns. So they were doing labor espionage as private parties and feeding the information that the FBI itself technically wasn't gathering right into the filing system of the FBI. And they've been doing this now for 100 years. You look out there to Wackenhut. Wackenhut is next FBI agent. You look at the roster of Pinkerton personnel, those are ex-FBI agents. You look at who's running security for Litton or ITT or any of these major corporations, these are FBI personnel. They get groomed, they get trained, they get their relationships, they get their basically set of affiliations set up, they get their priorities straight, and they're farmed out in the private sector to do the sorts of operational things in terms of surveillance, monitoring, and such that the FBI itself either doesn't have the manpower to do or for some reason doesn't want to be caught doing, but they get the information that way. So you got this nationwide net of political police out there, and it's been in existence for the better part of a century. We don't have to worry about what will happen if America becomes a police state. I've been hearing that all of my life. My God, if this keeps it up, we're going to be in a police state. Well, how many ups does it have to keep before we actually are in the police state? Is there some place you can look over your shoulder anywhere in the continental United States, and I don't care whether it's Pies, North Dakota, or DuPont Circle, where you're not likely to see a cop? Is there any place you can go that is not the ubiquitous presence of the overt symbology of the police, never mind the covert operatives, the plainclothes people that permeate society, the monitoring capacities and all the rest of that? Is there anything that you can do in your daily life that is not attached to a rule or regulation at this point? Tell me something. Anything that you can do. And I'm not asking, do you have the power to break the regulations, to break the law? You do, obviously, but that doesn't mean there's not a regulation or a law pertaining to it. And if you, as I do, define social freedom in terms of relative absence of regulation, you are in the least free society on the planet. Get used to it. The question is not what to do to prevent it. The question is what to do now that it's done.
Get the most freedom on
the
can.
Do you really?
Yeah.
He thinks he gets the most freedom he can. Try setting your can out in the middle of the street and see what happens to you. There's regulations where you're allowed to do that, so even that's not free.
We just passed a regulation in Richmond, Virginia, introduced and not passed, deciding that you cannot have people sleep in your living room and kitchen. The limited of people to get
Yeah.
Anti-immigration is that they fear that immigrants get their house and 20 of them live in it, and they don't want them to do that. So they have passes for immigration, so all passes and all this is given.
Yeah. Well, I'll take other suggestions, what you think you're doing that you're free to do. Somebody said something about breathing air. I've got three letters that I'll say to you, and that's EPA.
Are you urging us to get out? I mean, what are you?
Get out of what? Where are you going to go?
So what?
What do you think we should
do? Now that we're scared to death.
You're scared to death? Fear can be a good motivator. All right? I want you scared to death because that's a reality and a habitual practice in this society. And it doesn't matter whether you're Ozzie and Harriet living in suburbia or some paleo conservative out there in the fringes of the Freeman in Montana, or you fancy yourself a progressive, the reality gets blinked because we have a politics of the comfort zone that has pertained by and large to the entire trajectory of opposition in this country. And we need to get out of it. You got to understand what the reality is before you can conceive of effective means of countering it. So call things by their right names. Then you can call solutions by their right names and stop playing a game of let's pretend. And let's pretend is when we say, you know, we've got to curtail these, we've got to make these cosmetic changes, we've got to have community control over the police, we've got to make the FBI accountable to some discernible set of guidelines and so forth in order to prevent there being a police state. Hey, it's way late for that. Maybe that would have worked in, say, 1924.
Actually, what about you working in 1924? And actually, 1924, it was against the law to tie your alligator to a fire hydrant in Detroit.
It was against the law in Detroit to tie your alligator to a fire hydrant. If I'd known this, I'd have given up hope long ago. I thought at least I could park my alligator where I wanted, but I guess not. Yeah. Yeah, and this stuff will actually be enforced.
Minnesota's against the law to walk around with an ice cream cone in your pocket.
Yeah.
Other people, what do you recommend we do? And what
do you think
about the future of this?
I don't have an answer per se. Clearly not one that's going to work for everybody. I don't even understand a lot of the politics of the groups that are involved in the room. You're going to have to use the information in order to forge a politic that works for you. The way that I've approached it and the way that I know some other people approaching it seems one of the more viable strategies is the notion of affinity groups, the notion of dealing with people you have history with already, who you will be in proximity with, whose history you're going to continue to know, because people get changed. People do change, but people get changed as well. And if they're going to get changed to be a potential threat to me, I need to know about it. It's a kind of a paranoid, so it's a term that gets used, approach to things in a certain way. But on the other hand, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. When you're actually going to engage in an action of some sort, I mean, I sort of made that point to a guy yesterday who said, why don't we infiltrate the FBI and stuff? It's, you know, well, now he says, I guess since I said that, I probably can't do it. I said, now that you said it in a public place, probably nobody else can either. You know, you want to be thinking as if somebody was probably monitoring what you're saying. Okay, you make yourself a target for elimination if they take you seriously. You want to talk about things on the one hand, but not divulge what you're tangibly going to do. These kinds of things, which are precautionary. We've got big mouths. I got a really big mouth myself. I'm 55 years old. I'm probably not going to be engaged in the in-game move of this stuff anyway. So I'm trying to pass along what it is I picked up along the road to people who are younger than me, can put the information to work in ways that I was too dumb or uninformed to do in the first place. So there's that aspect of it as well. But I think the thing that has to be done primarily in terms of forging a viable politic is to dismantle this whole veneer of naivete. We carry a veneer, an image, an impression, of whatever of American innocence that is almost as nauseating as that held by the middle class. We can't believe they do this stuff. And every time they do, we think it's like inventing the wheel. Wow, they're infiltrating us. No shit.
Mark.
Yes.
Those of us doing the next workshop on what you can do would very much like a bright little glimmer ray of light here so that folks don't all be bummed out and become like gardeners in New Hampshire.
Oh.
Yeah.
Let me lay out a deterrent in a gardening in New Hampshire business then. You know, use a bludgeon rather than an incentive. Okay, depends on what you're growing. See how they work. What is happening here?
Could have been something you said.
Okay, a bright side, and that's a good point, Chip. You need something to work with. It's not that I'm really having a harder time thinking up something that might be of a positive kind. It's just that I'm laughing at how grim this stuff gets and how much got left out. But the upside of it is there is a certain continuity between the last generation of struggle and what it was that was done to us and what we learned as a result of that and making available the information, the operational techniques, and so forth, so that they can be understood before you're in the same situation that the Black Panther Party was. Before you're in the same situation of internal confusion that the Students for a Democratic Society was. Before they can do to you what they did to the Berrigans and so forth, you have the opportunity to use those precedents and those understandings for education to transform consciousness so that it won't resonate as being so plausible that a bunch of Catholic priests and nuns are going to run down into the tunnel system of Washington, D.C. and blow up the whole complex in order to take out Henry Kissinger. I mean, it's utterly preposterous, but it seemed plausible, and it seemed plausible because nobody could foresee it coming. Now you can. Now you can mount a cogent defense against these show trial things like what happened with the Panther 21. I mean, there was the aerosol can routine there, too. These guys, they had them with a bunch of hairspray cans. Okay, the hairspray cans were going to be used as the container devices for the making of a whole multiplicity of bombs using 1 ounce of black powder to take out the Bronx Botanical Gardens. Now, there's a strategic target. Macy's department stores and half the police stations in the borough of Brooklyn and Bronx. Utterly implausible on its face, but no one was making the argument until after the fact, and they were all open conspiracy charges. We have the capacity to now to respond in ways that were not possible in the 1960s, because frankly, in the 1960s, we didn't know a damn thing about the Palmer raids. We were making jokes about the CP, but we didn't really understand at the time it was a coherent federal program. That was not known. COINTELPRO did not become known until 1971. Now we know. And on the basis of knowledge, we can collectively. Sometimes it's hard to tell the anarchists from the FBI personnel. But to be equipped in that way is to be able to avoid some of that catastrophe. Probably not all of it. There is not a given technique or set of principles that you can apply that will prevent any and all of this from being effective. But you can defend yourself much more adequately in understanding the historical precedent of it, the purposes of it, how it functions, and how it's likely to come at you than if you're getting caught blindsided the way we did. And a little self-criticism on that. The information was available on the Palmer raids and stuff. We were the new left. So we had very little time and energy available in our self-important existences to look at the experience of the old left. Do not repeat that error either.
Can you say that again?
We were the new left. Okay, all of us, everybody I was talking about in the 60s comes under the rubric of the new left. And the new left was so self-absorbed, self-indulgent, self-preoccupied, self-aggrandizing, we didn't have time and energy to look at what it was that had been the experience of the old left. And if we had, we could have avoided some of this stuff too. But we didn't know about the Palmer raids because we didn't bother with it. That was what was happening then with those guys, with those archaic notions. We got a whole new politic. Well, we didn't have a new politic. Ultimately, the new left ended up with a regurgitation of everything that was crystallized in the old left. But it took us about 10 years of being obliterated to arrive at that point. And we could have come out with a much more constructive outcome simply by learning what it was that had happened in the preceding generation, two generations. Now, you got that generation standing here talking to you. I'm not retired, but I'm coming out of that experience. And that's the reason I'm talking about this grim stuff. It's not that there's no hope. See, I'm still talking. There's a lot of dead people in my background. There's a lot of people in prison or previously in prison. There's been a lot of things that were derailed in my life. But I'm still here and I'm still at it, and you can draw something from that too. They have not ultimately been effective. They did not ultimately accomplish what they set out to do. Chip Berlay's another one. He's been at it since before I was, probably. There's other people who were speaking in here yesterday. We cannot tell you what to do. All we can do is tell you what was done. And you can draw the logical conclusions, or illogical if that's what you want to do, from those. But pay attention to them because it affects you. And that was implicit in the comment that was made yesterday about, hey, they're infiltrating us at these incredible levels. It doesn't have to be a hot news flash. In the experience of other organizations, other groups, other movements, in terms of dealing with that and what was done to them, gives you a predictive power that was absent from us. The stuff about the allegation that was made about the liberals turning in the more radical member of the environmental movement to the cops. There's a lesson to be learned from that, because they will draw people into that, both sides. It's not like that's the first time that's ever happened. There's actually matters of principle to be considered in that connection, but there's also matters of objective and technique in the part of the state that need to be analyzed. And there's historical precedent and experience and conclusions to be drawn that can be brought to bear on that. But you have to actually look at it. You cannot reinvent the wheel every 15 minutes in hope to get any further along the line than we got. You'll end up in the same position that we did 20 years ago, and that is basically breaking traction, spinning your wheels, and going nowhere at all. Except maybe to jail. Except maybe into middle class existence. Oh, better jail, huh? Yeah.
That was Professor Ward Churchill speaking last week at the National Conference on Organized Resistance in Washington, D.C.
It was early springtime and the strike was on. It drove us miners out of doors, out from the houses that the company owned. We moved into tents up at Old Ludlow. I was worried bad about my children. soldiers guarding the railroad bridge. Every once in a while a bullet would fly, kick up gravel under my feet. We were so afraid you'd kill our children, dug us a cave that's 7 foot deep, carried our young ones and a pregnant woman down inside the cave to sleep. That very night you soldiers waited till all us miners was asleep. You snuck around our little tent town, soaked our tents with your kerosene. You struck a match and the blaze it started. You pulled the triggers of your Gatling guns. I made a run for the children, but a firewall stopped me. 13 children died from your guns. I carried my blanket to a wire fence corner, watched the fire till the blaze died down. I helped some people drag their belongings while your bullets killed us all around. I never will forget the look on the faces of the men and women that awful day when we stood around to preach their funeral and to lay the corpse of the dead away. We told the Colorado governor to phone the president, tell him call off his National Guard. But the National Guard belonged to the governor, so he didn't try so very hard. Our women from Trinidad, they hauled some potatoes up to Wallensburg in a little cart. They sold their potatoes and brought some guns back, and they put a gun in every hand. The state soldiers jumped us in the wire fence corners, did not know that we had these guns. And the redneck miners mowed down them troopers. You should have seen them poor boys run. We took some cement and walled.
The use of armed company goons against striking workers is back in vogue in Sudbury, Ontario, as Canada follows the United States down the road to corporate fascism. The familiar rhetoric of globalization was used to justify demands that Local 598 of the mine, mill, and Canadian auto workers give up contract provisions that had been won over decades. Times were a-changing, the company needed to become more globally competitive, the union was top-heavy with functionaries like safety and health advocates who failed to add value to the overall enterprise, and justifications of that nature. The 1,250 members of Local 598 seem no match for the deep pockets of the Noranda Corporation, which had a war chest of $2 billion, and attacked the union by hiring a private security firm, running scabs, and maintaining partial production despite the strike. Provincial laws passed by the Tory government of Mike Harris were all on the company's side. This was fully illustrated in late October, when a Sudbury judge slapped the union with a sweeping injunction and verbal tongue-lashing. Strikers were forced to stand by idly and watch scab workers and materials pass through their picket lines, and by early November it appeared that resistance to the Borg-like forces of globalization really was futile. Then, almost imperceptibly at first, the momentum began to swing back to the strikers. The hard rock miners, mill, and smelter workers of Sudbury staunchly resisted the siren song of company propagandists to return to work as individuals. They donned balaclavas in the bitter pre-dawn cold and fought low-level intensity guerrilla street battles with company goons, damaging vehicles and disrupting the flow of personnel and material despite the court injunction. The Canadian Auto Workers Union boosted strike pay and poured in additional resources to bolster morale and show support. The Sudbury community, long a union stronghold, rallied behind the strikers while isolating the company and its minions. Most of all, though, the 1,250 members of Local 598 showed resolute courage and determination to retain their union and its collective bargaining agreement at all costs. On Thursday, February 1st, the strike at Falcon Ridge in Sudbury, Ontario, entered its sixth month. The company has now conceded publicly that it wants an end to the dispute, that it's losing money, and that it will have to schedule temporary layoffs for its refinery workers in Norway because of the strike. While the outcome of the dispute remains far from certain, it's already clear that a group of determined workers may on occasion be able to trump the forces of globalization, no matter how powerful. Mick Lowe, a labor journalist from Sudbury, spoke with Jane Williams from Red Eye Radio in Vancouver late last month about the history of the strike and the union behind it.
The place is Sudbury, the metal is nickel, the company is Falcon Bridge, and the union is Mine Mill Canadian Auto Workers Local 598. The strike started in midsummer. On the line from his home in Sudbury to explain the background and discuss the stakes at this strike is Mick Lowe. He is an author and labor journalist. Hello, Mick.
Good morning.
Now, Local 598, I hear, is a union with a very proud history. Could you outline that history for us?
Yes, I can. It is unique, actually, in the annals of Canadian labor for this reason. It is the last surviving local of the Western Federation of Miners, which will be known to some of your listeners because it had a strong base as well in British Columbia. The WFM goes back to 1893, May actually of 1893, and it was formed as one of the earliest industrial unions on the continent to represent hard rock miners in the American and Canadian West. Some of your listeners will have heard of Big Bill Haywood or the famous songwriter Joe Hill. They were both products of the WFM, and the Wobblies, the International Workers of the World, is another outgrowth of the Western Fed. In 1916, it changed its name to the International Union of Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers, and in the early 40s, Local 598 was finally chartered here in Sudbury, principally at Inco, the other big nickel-producing company. But during the war and during much of the 1950s, Local 598, which represented the production and maintenance workers both at Inco and at Falcon Bridge, was the largest local union in North America. It had all 15 and sometimes as many as 20,000 members. It was, as one local, as large and as powerful as many whole unions are today.
And now it's the Mine Mill Canadian Auto Workers. How did that come about?
Well, it's a long and tortured history. In the 1960s, in the early 60s, well, let me jump back to the 50s in the McCarthy era. Of course, there were communist, anti-communist witch hunts going on across the continent, and Mine Mill was a major target. It was alleged that the union, and it was a very proud and very combative organization, and had undergone a period of number of periods of persecution in its history. But in the 50s, it was accused of having a communist leadership. And one by one, its locals were extinguished. They were raided by the United Steelworkers of America, which had the backing of the AFL-CIO, the American State Department, the CIA. One by one, raided the locals of Mine Mill, first in the U.S. and then in Canada, starting in the West and kind of moving east, until in the early 60s, Local 598, which was really the powerhouse of the whole Mine Mill, was raided by the steelworkers here in Sudbury. It was a bitter struggle that lasted for a couple of years. It divided brother against brother, father against son. It was a condition of near civil war. There were riots. Blood was shed. No one was ever killed. There were bombings. It was quite a time. It really divided the community and divided the workers of Sudbury. In the end, the steelworkers won by the narrowest of margin. Out of something like 14,000 votes cast, the steelworkers won by 8 votes, sort of like the American presidential election we've just witnessed. But at Falcon Bridge, the workers voted to remain loyal to Mine Mill. So, 598 dwindled from this massive, powerful trade union local down to a kind of a rump that represented only about 3,000 workers at Falcon Bridge. Local 6,500 of the steelworkers came in at INCO. Both these organizations still exist today. Local 6,500 of the steelworkers has about 3,500 members at INCO, and 598 has about 1,250 workers at Falcon Bridge. Of course, we've had downsizing along with everybody else. In 1993, I and a number of Sudburyans, people from all over Canada and the United States actually, gathered at the Mine Mill Hall, a very historic place here in Sudbury, to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Western Federation of Miners, which was in Butte, Montana, May 15th, 1893. But we were present on that night, 100 years later, to the night when the Western Fed had been formed in the last remaining union hall of that tradition. The next day, the members of the local voted to join the Canadian Auto Workers, the CAW. So what we now have is Mine Mill Local 598, as you correctly said, Mine Mill slash CAW. That, in a nutshell, that's the shortest version, long-winded as it was, that I can give you of this history.
Oh, no, it's very interesting history. So they're really kind of a proud union. And then on the other side is Noranda. Noranda's a huge corporation. How big is it?
Well, it is. It's actually, there's a triad of Canadian capital involved here. And I guess we'll start with the largest, which is Edper Brascan. It's a $10 billion Canadian enterprise that contains a number of branches within it. A chief within it is another huge company, Noranda, which is a mining company. And within Noranda, you have Falcon Bridge. So it's like a big fish being eaten by a still larger one, in turn eaten by a yet larger one. So these 1,250 workers at Mine Mill here in Sudbury, they're, you know, fairly small potatoes in the overall scheme of things, is now taking on this huge concentration of Canadian capital in Edper Brascan, Quay Noranda, Quay Falcon Bridge.
Now, the company pushed the workers to strike by demanding concessions in a new contract, and the CAW has said that it doesn't negotiate concessions. What did the company want to take away from the workers' previous gains?
Well, there, in the 1st of August is when the strike started, and the company offer that was on the table at that juncture included some 80 takeaways, really gutting contract language. Interestingly enough, they offered the INCO pattern settlement in terms of money. So, and that was acceptable to the workers at Mine Mill. So really, money is not the issue here. What is at issue, I think, fundamentally, is ideology. This is a company that in the first 6 months of last year had earned $235 million Canadian in profit. That's Falcon Bridge. They were well on their way to earning $500 million in pure profit for the year 2000, which would have been a record far and away for any Canadian nickel company in the history of the industry, which goes back more than 100 years. That's not going to happen now. We don't know what their profit figure will be. It should be announced next week. But they were making huge profits, record profits, and yet they had the gall to turn around and demand takeaways, serious takeaways, of their workers. And, you know, you can understand this at a time if a company is losing money or if it's about to go bankrupt, that they may come to the union and say, well, look, we'd like to renegotiate and gain some concessions here to help us stay afloat. But here you had a company that was in the middle of a stellar banner year, and yet they wanted not to share with their workers, but to take stuff away from the workers, and that just wasn't on.
Now, the company's also been using scabs, and I understand that this is something very unusual for Sudbury.
That's right. Mine Mill Local 598 was chartered in 1944, so we've had a continuous union history here, 56, 57 years. There have been a certain number of strikes, but never before in the history of the union movement in Sudbury has one of the big two nickel companies attempted to scab a legal strike. This really was something new under the sun, and it took everyone by surprise. We're talking hard rock miners here, and smeltermen, and mill workers, for the most part 90-95% male, increasingly numbers of women, though. So, and that's a good thing. But we're talking very, very tough individuals. And the notion that somehow you could run scabs through their picket lines was just anathema. And we all thought, well, war would break out if that were to happen. So everyone was taken off guard by this really audacious move by Falconbridge and Noranda to try to run some scabs through the picket lines in order to maintain a minimal level of production in the smelter.
And how did the workers respond when that happened?
Well, first of all, the company armed itself with some 200, an estimated 200 paramilitaries, or kind of a private army that they brought into town, all from the outside, to kind of protect the plant gates, to protect the vehicles as they were moving through the picket lines, to videotape constantly the activities of the strikers on the picket lines and so on, and to intimidate and provoke the strikers. But the long and the short of it is the scabs did go through, along with the office and technical staff, who are steelworkers union members and working with the contract, and supervisors. So as a group, they kind of screened one another, the legitimates and the illegitimates, so you really couldn't keep a head count of who was what and who was on first. And they did manage to get the smelter up and running to a certain degree. There was smoke coming out of the smelter stack, highly visible throughout the Sudbury district, and really anathema, really an unthinkable thing that in the middle of a strike there would be smoke coming from a smelter stack. The symbolism was just horrendous for the entire community.
Now, the product of the smelting was then sent to Norway, and I understand that there was a support strike in Norway.
That's right. The ore is not refined here in Sudbury. It's smelted here, but for refining, the finishing phase of production, it is and always has been shipped to a refinery in Norway, which is also part of Falconbridge. Those workers there are unionized. And they at first, this is interesting, they at first had a very hard time understanding what a scab even was. And then they had a hard time understanding how such a thing could be legal in a civilized country, that when you have a group of workers who are on strike legitimately, how could it conceivably be lawful that you would let people who weren't in the union go in and do their work? So that was the first thing that the Canadians had to explain, was how this could happen. And of course, the Harris government here in Ontario that had reversed the anti-scab law of the NDP government previously, really inviting employers to do this kind of thing in the event of a legal strike. So we explained all of this to the workers in Norway, largely via email, and eventually they came around to the notion that they should go on strike in sympathy. Globalization working for the workers for once, and they did go on strike for about 5 days in November, and very, very helpful, terrific boost to the morale of the people here in Sudbury, of course.
Oh, that's great. Now, I understand that you had a run-in with what you call the paramilitaries, the private army there, the 200 people brought in to police the strike?
Well, I did, yes. I and a friend, Stuart Cryer, who's a videographer, have been shooting some video off and on of the strike as it's gone on, with the notion maybe of making a small documentary or something at some point. We thought that it would be very important. Video has really become a weapon in this war because these paramilitaries, called AccuFacts, are constantly videotaping the activities of the strikers. So we thought we would go and videotape these paramilitaries, videotaping everybody else. So on the morning of December 13th, Stuart and I kind of crossed over no man's land between the two lines and just walked up very slowly and visibly, but with our video camera rolling, to the paramilitaries. And sure enough, they had their cameras trained on us, and they videotaped us while we were videotaping them, videotaping us. And the long and the short of it was, they really didn't like having their pictures taken. We were simply doing what they'd been doing to Sudbarians here for months on end, but when we did it to them, they called the police.
So you got arrested?
We were arrested. We were both charged with trespassing, and Stuart was charged with common assault. We have the whole incident on tape, It all lasted about a minute. They told us we were trespassing. We said, oh, sorry, where's the property line? They pointed it out. We were starting to move back. And the next thing we knew, they claimed that Stewart had assaulted them and basically detained us, kind of surrounded us physically and kept us there while they phoned the Sudbury Regional Police, who came and eventually arrested us and handcuffed us and carted us off to the police station in the back of a police cruiser.
Now, I understand that you were talking union to them while this was going on.
Well, that's the whole story, is that these guys don't give interviews. They're extremely camera shy, extremely mic shy. They're not really proud people. And they know that they don't belong here, and they know that there's a tremendous amount of hostility towards them in this community, which is a labor town, of course. So I kind of think they must have felt like General Custer at the Little Bighorn just when he saw the first couple of eagle feathers coming up over the rise. They know that they're in a world of trouble here. So they won't talk to journalists. They won't answer questions. So while we were being surrounded, being detained, I had about 15 minutes that I could talk to them. And I did. I talked to Blue Streak, and that was a bitterly cold morning, and I was doing jumping jacks, and I told them that I understood that they were working for about $11 an hour, and it was very cold out, and that somewhere somebody was sitting in a nice warm office making a profit off their labor. And that was a sure sign that they needed a union. And I had cards in my back pocket, and we were all willing to let bygones be bygones and sign them to the union, and on like that, being very careful to establish eye contact with each and every one of them at some point. And I've got quite a wide range of facial expressions, but not a word, not a peep. Told them they weren't having much fun either. They're a very, very sober bunch of guys, very serious. I realized later what it is they were scared to death to be here. I think they were even scared of Stewart and I, and I know they were scared of our camera and having their faces put on tape and possibly their identities revealed. So it was a very glum situation, and the fact is they weren't having near as much fun as the guys down on the picket line. They weren't making so much money, but they didn't have too much to say to me at that point.
Now, quickly, we have to go, but I wanted to ask you what the prospects are for the settlement of the strike.
Well, I'm sorry to say that they resumed talking on Monday last for the first time since the beginning of September. Talks lasted 3 days and then broke off again on Wednesday, with both sides seemed to be entrenched in the same positions they were at in October. So at this point, it doesn't look good.
Thanks very much for talking to us this morning, Mick.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Mick Lowe in Sudbury. Mick is a Sudbury columnist, labor journalist, and author who's written about Canada's nickel industry since 1974. His latest book is Premature Bonanza, Standoff at Voisey's Bay, published by Between the Lines.
That was labor journalist Mick Lowe speaking with Red Eye Radio's Jane Williams.
Unnatural disaster. Deregulated California utilities are electrocuting the public. Ohio is next. By Harvey Wasserman for Columbus Alive. Electric utility deregulation has become a spectacular catastrophe. Starting in California and stretching deep into our economic and ecological future, here in Ohio and nationwide. To keep it simple, we'll start with the top 10 truths about this unnatural disaster. 1. There is no electric supply shortage threatening California or the nation. Only a series of complex, cynical manipulations that have ramped prices sky high, yielding enormous profits for a few distributors and generators. 2. The deregulation bill at the root of this crisis was drafted by the California utilities now facing bankruptcy and was rammed through the California legislature unanimously in 1996 by the utilities' own lobbyists. 3. The Natural Resources Defense Council, through its chief energy spokesperson, Ralph Kavanaugh, and with support from the Energy Foundation, played a key role in drafting, passing, and then defending that bill. 4. But the California bill's catastrophic outcome was accurately predicted in intricate detail by a wide range of grassroots consumer and environmental groups that challenged the deregulatory scheme in a 1998 statewide referendum. 5. The utilities now screaming for help spent at least $40 million to defeat the referendum that would have saved the state and the nation from the current crisis. 6. The utilities now screaming for help walked off with more than $20 billion in, quote, stranded cost, unquote, bailouts as part of deregulation. But nobody seems to be able to account for where that money went, nor is there a concrete plan for getting that money back. 7. The consuming public would gain, not lose, if the utilities now threatening to go bankrupt actually did go bankrupt, and the public then took over the utilities. 8. The public-owned utilities that supply Los Angeles and Sacramento are prospering in the midst of this crisis, proving once again that public power is the answer to the nation's long-term energy needs. 9. Those municipal utilities are deeply invested in energy efficiency and renewable sources, wind and solar, which has provided them with a stable supply of power in the midst of this crisis. 10. Any new electricity production added to the state and national grid should come from wind, which is the cheapest and fastest to build new power source, and from solar, which can be installed on rooftops and at industrial sites, freeing homeowners and businesses from the lethal fluctuation of monopoly manipulations. The core of the California power crisis is simple. The utilities got greedy. They thought that they were taking the electricity business into a brave and profitable new millennium. Instead, they threw it back to a chaotic old century. In the 1880s, when Thomas Edison and others first made electricity a saleable commodity, rampant competition created chaos. Wires were strung everywhere, power plants popped up in bad places, service was abominable. But as the Morgans and Rockefellers inevitably swooped in to create stable monopolies, the public rebelled against price gouging and centralized private control. The barons who gobbled up the revolutionary new technology were confronted with the threat of being taken over by angry consumers. So Samuel Insull, the godfather of the new industry, came up with a compromise: regulation. From 1907 through 1920, virtually every state established its own regulatory commission to set rates and monitor growth and service in the electric power business. But the state commissions were rapidly taken over by the utilities themselves, and there were extensive flaws in the scheme, most notably its propensity to encourage the construction of massively expensive, inefficient, and dirty power plants. Along the way, massive abuses brought on the New Deal installation of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and other national controls. Since then, state and federal regulation has provided the nation with a relatively stable and reliable electric supply system. It has been stodgy and short on technical innovation. It has also stemmed the tide of public power, which still, where it's in place, provides cheaper and more reliable electricity than the private investor-owned utilities, regulated or otherwise. And, in fact, regulation is still in place in 27 states. Though Texas has insisted on deregulating in the midst of the California debacle, the chaos in the Golden State has pretty much stopped what looked like a national avalanche of state deregulations. In California, the disaster has taken the form of a mafia-style shakedown. As a price for ending regulation, the utilities demanded a $28.5 billion stranded cost bailout for their bad investments, most importantly, their obsolete, super-expensive nuclear power plants. In Ohio, the stranded cost tab has been more like $9 billion. What happened to that money? Nobody seems to know. Southern California Edison invested at least $5 billion in Asia. Pacific Gas and Electric bought up much of the power generation in New England and upstate New York. But in a huge shell game, the California utilities shifted those assets to their parent companies while leaving their distribution companies to flirt with bankruptcy and to get hundreds of millions more dollars in public subsidies. And as usual, the state is just handing over this money while demanding nothing in return. The power generators, the allegedly bankrupt utilities, and dozens of sharp operators manipulating the utility grid are all making out like bandits while blackouts roll through California. They're also using the power shortage as an excuse to demand construction of more fossil fuel and nuclear generators, burning natural gas, oil, and coal, and trying to revive the atomic energy industry, all to the detriment of the public and the environment, but all certain to generate gigantic profits for the very people causing the crisis. Here instead is what should happen. The public should take direct ownership of the utilities, which have clearly failed. The system should be controlled on a municipal basis, as in Sacramento and Los Angeles, and hopefully soon in San Francisco and other cities, towns, and counties across the state and nation. No new fossil fuel or nuke plants should be built. All new construction money should go to building windmills, solar panels, and increasing efficiency. Wind is the cheapest and fastest to build form of new generating capacity in the world today. Solar photovoltaic panels should be generating electricity atop virtually every rooftop in the nation, starting with all new construction. All water should also be heated by the sun, again starting with new construction. All this work should be done with union labor, starting with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, which has been training its labor force for just such a conversion. The California crisis is not one of supply. It's one of manipulation by an obsolete private utility industry and a fleet of cynical power generators. The solution is not to feed them still more warehouses full of money. The solution is to take them over, make them directly responsible to the public that owns them, and switch them over to wind and solar and increased efficiency. They say electric deregulation will be different here in Ohio. But the basic structure for corporate theft has been put in place here as well. And the solutions are ultimately also the same. That was Unnatural Disaster. Deregulated California Utilities Are Electrocuting the Public. Ohio Is Next. By Harvey Wasserman for Columbus Alive. Catch me
napping one day. The music used in today's program was The Ludlow Massacre by Woody Guthrie. Thanks to Vancouver Cooperative Radio for their contribution to today's program.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. To hell